Accession number 4583, Reel 1.
Wing Commander Helm, Reel 1. When did you first join the RAF, Wing Commander Helm?
1938.
And how did it come about?
Well, I was always interested in flying, right from my early days. And although my father was a dentist and I was actually supposed to be trained for the dental profession, my name was down for Guy's Hospital. In fact, I applied for a short service commission in 1938 and was called for a selection board. And very fortunately, a friend of mine had also applied approximately about 2 weeks before my interview and gave me pretty well all the questions that he had been asked. So consequently, I was very well versed in the answers when my selection board came up.
What type of questions were there?
Well, mostly to do with navigation and my interest in flying, mentioning popular flying in some of the periodicals of that time, and also questions regarding First World War pilots, Ball, McCudden, various other people, to find out just how much I had read or how much I knew of the service.
How much did you know about the conditions of service before you joined?
Well, pretty well everything. I was quite aware of what the Short Service Commission was. A very great friend of mine had been accepted approximately about 6 months before I had, and he was already under his elementary training when I joined.
What did the Short Service Commission involve?
Well, 4 years on the active list and 3 years on reserve.
And what was it that really attracted you to the RAF?
Well, one, I wanted to fly, and secondly, I wanted to obtain the civil licenses that went with the pilot, because at that time I did have the offer of a job from Alan Cobham before I actually went into the service, but one of the conditions was that I was a qualified pilot before I could join his circus.
Who or what was Alan Cobham's circus?
Well, Sir Alan Cobham had an aircraft company, and he was the forerunner of the displays. He went round various fairs and shows in the country and gave demonstrations of flying with the aircraft. He was prepared to accept me, providing I was RAF trained.
How had you got into contact with him?
Through my father.
Was your father in?
No, he was nothing to do with any of the services at all, but he happened to know or have contact with Sir Alan Cobham.
What was the reputation of the RAF in those days?
Well, I would describe it as being one of the best flying clubs in Europe. You had the prestige of being commissioned rank. You were also a pilot, and in those days, flying an aircraft was something unique. I don't know, it just sort of put you head and shoulders above most of the other people of your own age.
How did its reputation compare with the two older services?
Well, it was a very junior service, and in my initial period of time, I found that the RAF was not really known too well by the Army or the Navy. They were not aware of our ranks or uniform or anything else. In fact, this persisted right through until the first days of the war.
After your interview, what happened then?
Well, I had the interview at Adastro House, and I was then handed a chip to go and be medically examined, so I was aware that I had got through the first barrier, and I went down to the medical section where I was duly medically examined, and I was passed completely fit. Having completed that, I returned home and duly waited notification from the Air Ministry as to the result of the interview and medical examination.
And then when you had the result, what
happened? Well, I had the result by letter, which told me that I had been accepted for a short service commission and that instructions would be sent to me later telling me what unit I was to join and where my flying training was to be carried out, which again duly arrived approximately about June 1938, which told me that my elementary flying training would be carried out at Prestwick, number 12 FTS. And I drove up to Prestwick and joined number 12 EFTS. They were flying Tiger Moths at the time. The squadron leader McIntyre was the commanding officer of the unit, and most of the instructors, including mine, were Reserve Air Force officers.
What was it like flying Tiger Moths?
Well, I found it delightful. The Tiger Moth is one of the world's aircraft that does not have any faults. If there are any faults, you make them. And our record at 12 EFTS was pretty good. I think there were only two crashes while I was there.
What was the atmosphere there at the flying school?
Well, very good indeed. My course had about 30 pupils on it, drawn from all walks of life, from London policemen to bank clerks, etc., etc. And we lived in the Orangefield Hotel, which was a privately owned hotel within the grounds of Prestwick Airport. It's still there. And we were civilians. We had not been commissioned into the Air Force at that time. But all our training was carried out parallel flying groundwork. And at the end of 3 months, we had our intermediate examinations to find out exactly how we were progressing. And we were checked occasionally by Air Ministry or RAF instructors from the Central Flying School. And some of the fellows didn't make it. They got thrown off the course. I was one of the fortunate ones. I managed to get through. And we completed our initial training. And then we were all posted to Uxbridge.
Before we go on to Uxbridge, can you tell me what the intermediate exam consisted of?
Well, it was a mid-term examination. It was you were examined in all the ground subjects that you had been studying for the first part of the course. Navigation, meteorology, instruments, engines, airframe, rigging. It was a reasonably good examination. I must admit that I failed it. I unfortunately didn't do well in the navigation paper. In fact, I hadn't been doing any studying at all. My main interest was in flying, and that was all I was really bothered about, until it was brought home to me fairly forcibly that unless I was re-examined and passed, I would not be on the course. Well, during the summer break, or the intermediate break between courses, I had to get down and do some study, and was re-examined in those subjects I'd failed in, and I managed to scrape through, and I went on to complete the course.
So you always had the second chance if you failed the first time?
Well, yes, everybody was given a very reasonable chance. It wasn't just a question of saying he's no good off the course. You were, certainly in ground subjects, given a chance, and if the instructors thought that you had the aptitude for flying, then of course you were re-examined.
Can you describe what your daily routine would have been?
Well, it depended entirely on what the program of training was. For instance, in the morning, one morning, you might have been on ground subjects, in other words, in the classroom, and in the afternoon you would then switch over and be in the flying section. So in other words, you'd be flying. That was really the routine.
Was the work very hard there, or was it a relaxed atmosphere?
No, it was, I would say, was a relaxed atmosphere. There was no pressure brought to bear on anybody at all. You just got on with your work and carried on in your own sweet way. You made mistakes, as everybody did. But your instructor was the crux of the whole of your career. If he was satisfied that you had the caliber to make a service pilot, and you were worth taking the trouble over, then trouble would be taken.
What was the discipline like at Prestwick?
Our discipline was fairly rigid. We had representatives on the course who were in charge of the course pupils, and they were responsible for ensuring that certain things were done. That is, getting up in the morning and getting up to the classroom and so on and so forth. It was a semi-military discipline, but not a military discipline.
Was the discipline fair?
Oh yes, quite fair. I would say it was quite fair. Nobody had any complaints at all.
How old were the chaps on the course?
Approximately my own age, which would be about 20.
What type of things did you do in your free time?
Well, played golf, went drinking in Dal Blair and Ayr. I was fortunate, I had a car. Chase girls, you name it, we did it. It was a very relaxed atmosphere.
So you weren't rigidly confined?
Oh, no, no, we were not confined in any shape or form. Our free time was our own. We could do and well and go where we pleased. There were no rules that said you had to be here, you had to be there, or you had to do this, you couldn't do that.
How much choice at this early stage in your RAF career did you have with the direction your career would take?
Very little. You had been commissioned into the general duties branch. We were all general duty pilots who were on the course, and that's it. When you say general duties, it means exactly what it says. Any duty.
So that if a particular young man had a liking for something like, say, navigation or whatever, would he not be able to put pressure on to take up that particular
line?
Well,
no, he didn't put pressure on, but it was noted, particularly by the instructors and ground instructors. If he had a special aptitude for flying, or he had a special aptitude in ground subjects, it was noted, and it would be taken into consideration in future postings. There was a selection process going on the whole time you were training.
Did you feel that that happened in your own particular
nope.
case?
No, I was just one of the average hoi polloi. I just went through, all I wanted to do was fly, and that was it. It didn't really bother me what happened. We virtually knew what followed on, what our career aspect was going to be. We were going to do service flying training when we actually were commissioned into the Air Force, followed by posting to a squadron and then squadron service. And that really is all that one could ask for.
How long did the course last?
3 months.
You said that you were then posted to Uxbridge.
That's right. We were then, we were successfully, we passed the course. We had our final examinations and our final flying examinations as well. And we all received our A licenses before leaving Prestwick, because we'd qualified as a private pilot anyway. And we then received posting instructions from Air Ministry through Prestwick to say that we were being posted to Uxbridge prior to being embarked for overseas service at No. 4 FDS.
What's an A licence?
An A licence is the old pre-war civil pilot's licence. there were two categories, A and B. B was the commercial pilot's license, A was the private pilot's license.
And when you arrived at Uxbridge, what was your impression?
Well, we then actually entered into the RAF proper, and most of our time was taken up with, obviously, drill and discipline, injections for overseas service, and kitting out.
Was the disciplinary regime very different to what it
had
been?
Oh, very different indeed. We actually then joined the service. When we arrived, we were all in civilian clothes, of course. We didn't have any uniforms, and our first lecture that we received from one of the admin officers there was the kitting out procedure. In fact, what we were entitled to receive from the Air Ministry in uniform, and what uniforms we had to have, and so on and so forth. And I always remember he gave us a lecture on the number of outfitters that were approved by the ministry that we could use, and they were Gieves and Moss Brothers, Simpsons, and quality tailors like this. And I always remember, because I rather thought he was a little bit anti-Semitic in his outlook, because most of us chose Moss Brothers. I was one of them, as being the tailor I would like to do all my outfitting, and he was very scathing about this.
And Moss Brothers is run by Jews,
well,
is it?
Obviously Moss Brothers is a Jewish concern, and he was quite scathing about it. But anyway, the representatives of the tailoring firms came down to Uxbridge and measured us for uniforms and mess kit, greatcoats, raincoats, etc. And for this we received a grant from public funds, of course, to pay for it.
Was it adequate?
Yes, I would say to a certain extent it was adequate. It wasn't adequate if you wanted to buy extra things, such as uniform trunks and this, that, and the other, which I did. I still got them, actually.
Was the uniform smart in those days?
Yes, I think it was a very smart uniform indeed. It was rather different to the type of uniform that's worn now.
What were the differences?
Well, we had a tunic which was, I think you've got some in the museum here with patch pockets on, fairly deep ones, and it was comfortable and well fitted. Our mess kit, of course, we were going overseas, so we had to be kitted out with white cutaway jackets and instead of the blue ones, cummerbunds and all this sort of thing. Which were extremely smart. But this, of course, cost quite a bit more than the normal allowance would run to. So we got a special allowance because we'd been posted to Egypt.
At what stage at Uxbridge did you get to know about your posting to Egypt?
Well, we actually got to know about it before I left Prestwick, because posting instructions had been sent to Prestwick before we left. So everybody was aware that our advanced flying training was going to be done at number 4 FTS.
Did you know how long you would be at Uxbridge before you went to Egypt?
No, we had no idea. But in actual fact, it turned out to be about 6 weeks. Because we had to learn the rudiments of drill. We were square bashing most of the time under a flight sergeant. And then, of course, we had to have inoculations, which I think knocked everybody on the course out, particularly TAB. So none of us were feeling very fit. And the bank accounts were opened for us, which many of us hadn't had bank accounts before.
How did you and your friends react to the square bashing?
Oh, everybody took it in good heart, you know. I mean, I fortunately had some previous experience, because prior to joining the Air Force, I had been a territorial private in the London Scottish. So square bashing was not new to me. I did the rudiments of rifle drill and drill.
So your 6 weeks was basically spent on the square, was it?
Yes, on the square. We didn't have any instruction or anything like that at all, except in KR and ACIs.
What's that?
King's Regulations and Air Ministry Instructions. It's the Bible of a service officer. It's an extremely thick book, of course not amended. So we spent most of our time amending the copies we got. And there were hundreds and thousands of amendments. You know, delete the words whereas and in put in something else, and you had to cut this out and stick it in. And we were doing this. And we also received lectures from admin officers on conduct and behaviour befitting an officer.
And what did that behaviour consist of?
Well, in other words, I think normally what you'd learned at home, how to behave. Things that you do and don't do.
Can you give some examples of what he said?
Well, I think mostly mess etiquette, which was new to most of us. I mean, mess etiquette, it's known as it's known in the services, one doesn't carry out at home. But basically nothing really more than that.
Was it a question of behaving honourably, was it?
Well, yes. Another question was, of course, that women are never mentioned in the mess. And passing the port and sherry, of course, how to do this. This sort of thing in general, which I think most of us wanted to know anyway, the finer points of behaving in the service.
Was the question of gambling and indebtedness mentioned?
Oh, yes. Well, of course, that obviously would be. Gambling was out of the question, other than bridge. Wish there was a bridge book in the mess, of course, and your debts, etc., were put down in the bridge book, but that was the only thing that was allowed. Nothing more.
Did you and your friends remain solvent in the
event? Oh, yes. Yes, we did. We got the princely sum of 11 shillings per day, including danger money, when we first joined.
Why did you receive danger money?
Well, flying an aircraft in those days was considered dangerous, whether it was or not. So we received a danger allowance over and above our normal salary.
Was that very substantial?
No. Well, 11 shillings per day, out of which I think 3 shillings was danger money. So it gives you the answer to the question. It wasn't what I would call a well-paid job.
But was it adequate for what you
needed? Oh, it was adequate. Money went a long way in those days.
Coming on to your posting to Egypt, what was your reaction when you heard that you were going there?
Well, it was a mixed feeling, actually. Most of my friends had been posted to service flying training schools in this country. And although I was looking forward to it, was a bit gratified to know that I was going abroad, I didn't really know what to look forward to. One heard varying rumours of 4FTS, which didn't have a very good reputation in those days. It was reputed to be an extremely well-run flying training school. Discipline was high, and well, they didn't suffer fools gladly. I didn't quite know what to expect when I got there.
You were a bit apprehensive about it, were you?
A bit apprehensive, yes.
What about going to Egypt itself?
Well, this was done by troop ship, the Samaria, which sailed from Southampton. And it was at the time that the Civil War was on in Spain. And we went right down the Spanish coast, of course, through the Bay of Biscay. And as, of course, and we arrived at Port Said. Unfortunately for us, we had to stay overnight at Port Said because there were no trains running through to Cairo that night.
Why unfortunately?
Well, fortunately, in fact, because it gave us a chance of getting out into Port Said and seeing what the flesh pots of Port Said offered, which were fairly numerous, to us anyway.
What type of flesh pots did they consist of?
Well, nightclubs, women, you name it, it was there. Port Said in those days had a reputation, which it didn't lose for a long time.
You were free to do this, were you?
Oh, yes. We were actually left much to our own devices. There was a group captain, Forbes, in command of the contingent, the ship. He was a senior officer on the ship. And he didn't really care a damn. We got to Port Said and we were all told to behave ourselves, but we were free to go anywhere and do whatever we wanted overnight, which we did.
You said that the Spanish Civil War was in progress.
Yes,
as you passed the coast of Spain. Did that affect you in any way?
No, the only thing that we saw of the Spanish Civil War were two gunboats, Spanish gunboats, that were sighted one morning that came fairly close to the trooper, but sheered off. They didn't interfere with us at all.
After your stay at Port Said, what happened then?
Well, we entrained for Abu Swer, which is just by Ismailia, and we went down there by train, detrained at the other end, and were met by personnel, including the station warrant officer, at Abu Swer, and we were taken up to the camp.
What was that like?
Well, that was a typical then Middle East encampment. It was a permanent Royal Air Force station. Wooden-built huts, ablution blocks, typical pre-war hangars, no runways, they were just hard-packed sand. And the system they ran at the Flying Training School was that there was a senior course and a junior course. The senior course was the students that had come 3 months before we'd arrived and had actually completed the first 3 months and were then going on to do their advanced flying training. So we, in actual fact, became the junior course to the course that had passed into advanced training. And the usual procedure was followed. They put on a show for us, which disheartened most of us. They took the part of officers of the squadrons there, training squadrons, and told us a load of tarry-diddle about what life was going to be like out there at number 4 FTS, which most of us, by the time they'd finished, were quite happy to pack their bags and go on back home.
Why? What type of things did they say?
Oh, they were telling us that discipline was terrible and we wouldn't get through the training and, you know, you were expected to do this, that and the other, and in fact life sounded pretty be-awful.
Was it an accurate report?
No, it wasn't. It was just a pure show that was put on by the outgoing course.
Did you do the same when
we
you left?
We did the same thing, yes.